Thank you, gentlemen. Let me ask my first question to Chairman Finley. Your testimony indicates that a separate administrative process should be allowed for the trust administration class. Would you please explain why the ability to opt out of the class to pursue the claims individually is not sufficient?
Well, the real reason why was we tried to get at the people who fell through the cracks. Our hope is that the parties would recognize the problem and rectify it in making the money available for this third option that we proposed within our suggestions in the written testimony that you have. And so I guess, you know, it being an emotional issue, people want emotional closure. I think that that would give them an opportunity to be heard and to hopefully see some compensation for their losses that they've incurred over the years.
Are you aware of the Equal Access to Justice Act being used in other litigation settlements against the U.S.?
Yeah. Offhand, I don't really know of any others other than the one that was previously done in this case. We've heard that individuals would prefer that the attorney fees come from some other means. I think a lot of the concerns that we've heard throughout Indian country, and it's been mentioned here today, that people have a problem with that large amount of money coming out of the settlement itself.
All right, let me ask Chairman Nunes. Upon congressional enactment of the proposed legislation, the Department of Interior will begin implementation of the Secretarial Commission on Trust Reform. Do you have any recommendations as to how the commission should operate?
Yes, sir. It certainly should include Indian trust landowners, if at all possible, and to make sure that there is certainly transparency and that continual education and information be provided to the landowners.
Thank you for that. Professor Monette, you testified that the U.S. has spent approximately $100 million per year on attorney costs to litigate this matter, yet you question the plaintiff's attorney fees in the range of $50 to $100 million. That's what you question for the same 14 years. Why do you think the U.S. spent 14 times more for attorney fees than the plaintiffs?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question, Mr. Chairman.
Well, you've, according to your testimony, you say the U.S. has spent approximately $100 million per year on attorney costs to litigate this matter, and yet you're questioning the plaintiff's attorney fees in the range of $50 to $100 million. Is that correct?
Well, it's not correct. I haven't really questioned the attorney's fees, although I share the concerns that the other panelists have raised. The $100 million that the department has told us is that what they've spent for doing the special trustee work every year out of the money that they've otherwise gotten. And so what I pointed out, that it's about $100 million for 14 years, which adds up to $1.4 billion, which is the exact amount of the settlement. So what I've suggested is that perhaps the tribes, they apparently think the tribes and their members are supposed to be elated for getting $1.4 billion of money that was otherwise appropriated for their benefit in the first place.
All right. I appreciate that clarification. Do you know what the average percentage award for attorney fees in other class action settlements is?
I don't know, and they are all over the board. It's not uncommon, as you know, in tribal matters that for them to be 10%, as we have a federal statute that is on point. They have been as high as 40%. But generally, that has been a percentage of amount that the court has ordered. And here the court ordered $455 million. And then we got two sides that basically colluded to add more money to that and then for attorney's fees to be added. And it's a very clear sort of rule, Mr. Chairman, that deals with that issue. There are probably three or four of them. Generally, and this was part of my testimony written to you, courts particularly look for signs that a class action settlement resulted from a reverse auction. Collusive agreements between the defendants and the class representatives, often in exchange for generous attorney fees. As the ABA article that I pointed out notes, this is a quote, by this tactic, the defendant hopes to preclude all other claims, which is precisely what is happening here with the trust administration claims, which is why I wrote then after that paragraph, the proposed settlement, at least on this issue, will be a poster child of such reversed auction settlements. It also flies in the face of a very difficult development with settlements that is attempting to address the question you're asking about settlement-only provisions. As I wrote, similarly, the U.S. Supreme Court has directed courts to scrutinize settlement-only class action lawsuits, where classes are certified and claims are made solely for the purpose of settlement, which is what we got here, without scrutiny and without sufficient information. So we have, for the first time, a second class, a trust administration class, that none of us have seen before. Now, it may be a good idea. It may be the only way to work out the kinks in this settlement. But nobody has seen it. I have not talked to a single, I have talked to many tribal leaders, not a single one that has even heard of the idea, except for, of course, the very small number of tribal leaders that the plaintiffs are working with. And so this is the classic settlement-only provision. The proposed settlement provision establishing a new trust administration class at the 11th hour with claims that were neither made nor litigated will become the poster child of the settlement-only problem that the Supreme Court has frowned upon. It also likely violates reverter clauses, although, quite frankly, that provision is so ambiguous in the proposed settlement that I couldn't quite understand it. But the court disfavors reverter clauses which specify that unclaimed funds revert to the defendant. First, there was all the incentive to provide more money than the claim asked, or more money than the court ordered, I'm sorry. But then, once the claims are made difficult to make, that money's reverting back to the defendant. That's the kind of reverter clause that precisely this body, the Congress, suggested are unfair in class action lawsuits. And as I wrote here, this is especially relevant in this settlement, since normally plaintiffs would administer distribution of awards. They are going to help the plaintiffs. The defendants are going to help the plaintiffs administer this award. In fact, they will play a key role. These reverter clauses allow counsel to agree. This is, again, out of the ABA article. These reverter clauses allow counsel to agree to an inflated settlement amount that serves as the basis for calculating attorney fees while providing an incentive to discourage members of the class from making claims. With attorney fees based on the overall amount and the defendant administering claim awards, this settlement again will be the poster child of this frowned upon reverter clause in the rules. So my written testimony will point out where I think several of the provisions run afoul of two or three laws that this body has adopted to protect class participants. This settlement is asking this body to play along, to make broad waivers of any other applicable law so that it can reach a settlement that otherwise they could not have reached, to grant jurisdiction to a court in ways that had not been granted before in this matter, so that money could be on the table. And all we are asking is that if we can have the transparency and the time to look at these matters to make sure that tribes are at the table, tribal leaders, as you apparently we've recognized here in the Land Consolidation Fund, tribal leaders are largely absent from the discussion. In this so-called Education Scholarship Fund, the plaintiffs are going to propose a nonprofit organizations to administer scholarship funds, all without the tribes, and I don't think the tribes would agree with all of that. They may agree with some, but quite frankly, with the short timing, we really just don't know.
Mr. Hastings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My first question is to Chairman Finley. Before redistricting, I represented the Okanagan County part of the Colvilles. I don't now. I might sneak over a little bit there at Grand Coulee, but just a small part. But at any rate, you're here representing ITMA. And if you said it in your testimony, I missed it. But what do you hear from your constituents in Washington State on this issue?
I think I pointed that out in my testimony, that many of them are questioning how this can be brought without their consent. I think it's been stated earlier that this is the first of its kind in any country, and it truly is. My constituents turn to me for these answers. They expect their elected body to bring issues like this to the forefront. In this case, that has not happened. So when they turn to me and ask me for questions and I don't have them, it creates a difficult situation for me as a tribal leader, because I should be doing those things for them. Some of their issues are the emotional issues that you've heard. Some of them believe that the terms as they understand them, if they do understand them, are unfair to them. Some of them think that they're good and they'll benefit them in a number of areas. It's across the spectrum, but I do want to underscore the fact that I've continually heard that they expect me as their tribal leader to have these answers for them. And I've tried to find those answers from the best that I possibly can.
And you would anticipate the chairman of other tribes would have similar concerns and similar questions from their constituents too?
I've heard similar concerns from other tribal leaders.
Which then raises a question I want to ask then to all three of you, because we have heard it. I think there's general agreement that this has to be put this behind us. I mean, we are at a point where there is at least a settlement in front of us. There are some questions about that. The questions center on transparency and maybe a final decision, at least a comfort zone of all of you. So my question then to all of you, what would you advise us to do in order as we move through on this process? Now, keep in mind, this settlement was reached on December 7th, and it was supposed to be culminated on December 31st. It's now being kicked ahead to April 16th. Presumably, it can be kicked ahead again. But at what point and what should we be doing in order to satisfy the transparency that I sense all of you want to have more of and so forth? What advice can you give us? We'll start with you, Chairman Finley.
I think if the parties involved would do outreach across the nation throughout the various regions, that would go a long ways in addressing some of the concerns and questions that many of the Indian beneficiaries have, as well as tribal leaders.
Okay. Ms. Nunez?
I certainly agree with the statement from Mr. Finley. The plaintiffs actually are scheduled to come out within the next 2 weeks to Arizona to meet with the tribes there. But I also think that the Department of Justice and Department of Interior also need to do the field hearings in conjunction with the Ms. Cobell's group. But certainly all information that can be granted and provided to the individual Pilates and tribes needs to get out there so that everybody can feel comfortable in moving this forward.
Professor Burnett?
I would ask the committee to bear in mind that all of these individual Indian money accounts and the interest are derivative of these people's membership in tribes, largely derivative of their membership in tribes that entered into treaties with the United States. And those tribes belong and deserve to be at the table. I would add that perhaps there could be a judicial referral of the money claims to the federal court, waiving the United States sovereign immunity, and that so that the court could actually address these matters, and maybe the settlement then would make more sense. It wouldn't appear to be as collusive. I would ask this body to direct settlement negotiations to comply with the Class Action Fairness Act and the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. They can be waived at the end, because obviously that's what we're asking now. But right now we haven't had a settlement with them applying. It would be nice if the settlement negotiations were in compliance with those laws, maybe with the idea that there would be some necessary waivers at the end. But right now, those laws are requiring the things I mentioned and very stringent requirements regarding notice. And I think it's fair to say that that has not been followed. The clear, concise, and easily understood language, the Supreme Court addressing that rule in a recent case, requiring a desire to actually inform absent class members. I'm a member of this class, and I can say in no uncertain terms that I have never once, in no way, shape, or form, have I ever been contacted by plaintiff's attorneys or by the named plaintiffs to ask what I thought, to ask what I felt about it. And, I mean, this committee and your staff knows I'm pretty easy to find. So I think that should be complied with as well.
Well, ultimately, the decision rests with us, because we have to have legislation, which, by the way, hasn't been introduced. At what point I guess in this whole process, should we feel a comfort level that you have all been satisfied that the transparency and the procedures are enough to satisfy all of Indian Country, or is that the $64 question always? Any one of you?
I think when the tribal leaders have given a chance to look at it and to talk about it, and right now at first blush, we're going to find tribal leaders that absolutely oppose this at one end, and those who think, oh, it absolutely should go forward at the other end, we could cherry pick from either end. If they all get a chance to talk this out, I think we'll come up with a consensus. And if the tribal leaders, true to my talk here this morning, if they think that this should go forward, I'm all for it.
Well, then that then lends this opportunity, because if we're going to have to ultimately make that decision, we are going to have to hear from tribal leaders and individuals. We welcome that. I think on all sides welcome that. But if there is some real heartburn, so to speak, on this process, we really need to know what that heartburn is and the depth of that heartburn throughout this whole process before we can make that decision. So I would respectfully ask all of you, with the contacts you have throughout Indian Country, to share that with us as soon as possible so that we can proceed forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Gentleman from American Samoa, Mr. Falamavuega.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to follow up with my good friend from Washington's question, and as well as his opinion. And I was going to ask all of you three gentlemen, is it your understanding, in order to move this proposed settlement that is now being discussed, that there has to be some kind of a federal legislation to actually implement the process? Or can this just be done by executive authority of the administration?
It's my understanding that the decision rests with Congress to give the court the authorization to move forward on the settlement terms that are before everybody today.
It is also my understanding that the legislation is required.
Professor Monet?
You know, early on we were told, 14 years ago, told about really the strategy and genius of the strategy of the case, that it was not asking for money. So it would not run any red flags up the polls. It was simply asking for a corrective accounting, a reconciliation. And that's why it was able to be brought in the federal district court as a declaratory and injunctive matter. But as soon as the accounting, evidently the appeals court doesn't agree, but we were told that an accounting can't be done, the monetary damages became more plausible. But in order to get monetary damages, as you know, that requires a waiver of sovereign immunity from the United States, likely a judicial referral on this. So the settlement as it is cannot be done solely by the executive branch, by the administration. It requires this body's stamp of approval as it is.
Well, you know, in the years that I've served as a member of this committee, we've had this yo-yo relationship going back and forth between the administration and the Congress in determining exactly how much money is involved here, this mismanagement. And I believe this is one of the critical factors is why Ms. Cobell felt that we need to file a lawsuit, because we're not getting anywhere. Now, 14 years later, we are now at this point, as I've said previously to my statement, I cannot believe that this is the amount of money that is being involved. And I honestly believe it's a lot more than $3.5 billion or whatever. I wanted to ask you, when Ms. Cobell initiated the lawsuit, what was the reaction from Indian Country? Did any of these 250 tribes went and give her moral support as well as financially when she was struggling to put this through the federal court system? Professor Monet?
I think it's fair to say that my tribe did. My tribal leader, who I respect greatly, Twyla Martin Kakaba, at that point pulled me aside and talked with me about it. I know that there were very warm feelings for the Native American Rights Fund at the time, and that we thought that the Native American Rights Fund was going to see this case through to the end, win all those $170 billion that Mr. Falamavuega would apply here, and I'm all with you on that. And NARF would get their fair share of that. Looking at the settlement today, the Native American Rights Fund is not even listed as class counsel. And I'm sure that they want to be, but I'm sure that they recognize at this point there are some very sort of dangerous conflicts of interest for them putting it in there today. But I can tell you at that time that that's the discussion we had.
I sense also from reading your statement and your comments, Professor Monet, that in your honest opinion that the current process as evolved with the involvement of the Department of the Interior, is the process agreeable to you both legally and policy-wise, or do you have some serious questions on how we came up with where we are now, where the Secretary Salazar has given agreement to this proposed $3.7 billion that we're going to provide the settlement?
One thing that we haven't heard here yet, I assume we will, but the department certainly hasn't been with clean hands throughout this process. We've seen them basically taking five IAM accounts and massaging them into one over time. We've seen them preparing for the settlement where we had people who have trust interests in land out there who had no IAM account, and they created an IAM account. All of this is to cast a broader net for buy-in, along with the land consolidation funds and scholarships and all that. There's been authority for land consolidation for since 1934, frankly, since the Indian Reorganization Act. There have been authorization from this body for scholarships. They've always been underfunded, and they should be funded. What they have to do with this settlement, other than dangling a carrot in front of a people for buy-in, is beyond me. There's a better process. We're better than this. This is of a historical moment for our people. 50 years from now, we will look back and look at that, frankly, that indefensible law that this body passed 100-plus years ago, the General Allotment Act, and we will look at this as an attempt to fix part of it forever. And I hope it would as well. But if we're going to do that with that much historical moment, we might as well do it right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think my time is up. If I could just raise one short comment to Mr. Nunes, the chairman or the member of the Odhono tribe in Arizona. I visited your tribal nation there a couple of years ago with my cousins who played for the University of Arizona football team, and I was just wanted to ask you if our high school football team is coming along okay. I'm going to ask my cousin, who's currently the defensive coordinator for the University of Arizona, to pay you another visit to make sure that our high school there is coming along okay. If it's all right with my friend Raul here, we can do that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Monet, I heard an expression once that the enemy of the good is the better. Now, and I think that has a lot of truth. I've been here about a year, and it seems like it's very hard to get anything done. You're talking about 50 years from now. It almost seems like this could still be litigated 50 years from now. Clearly, there's some, I gather from you guys, some problems with the legislation. On the other hand, it does seem to redress some things which need to be redressed, and it seems to bring conclusion something that seems like it could go on forever. What are your thoughts about that statement? And Mr. Nunez, and I appreciate both you gentlemen's perspective on that, too.
I'm in agreement that the time is now or near to get this all behind
us. But it doesn't seem like it's going to happen now or near unless this is...
The problem with that is the broad brush that this has been done, and the devil is in the details, or the devil should be in the details here, and some of the details are missing. My tribe, for example, the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa, the reservation was too small when the allotment came, when the Allotment Act came about, so 2,500 heads of households were granted allotments 500 miles away from the tribe, in South Dakota, in Minnesota, and in Montana. Those allotments are so far from the tribe that the tribal government, as a tribe, as a collective body, has not been able to pay attention to those claims and those allotments over the years. Many of them have been lost. We, on occasion, find telephone lines running through the middle. We find that some of them have had oil pumped out of them without ever there being a lease. This was all the subject of the Senate Committee on Investigations, long investigation about 20 years ago, over 3 years. Now, none of that has been resolved yet. Some of those claims could be worth, frankly, thousands or millions. But this legislation will dangle in front of my tribe and my tribal members, where there is 80% unemployment, dangle $500 in front of them and say, will you take this in exchange for whatever has happened in the past? And I'm afraid they're going to say yes. And, you know, everybody's got their own will, but at least I want them to know that.
Let me hear from the other two gentlemen.
I would say that there are some issues that will be resolved through the settlement. However, as you mentioned, and others have mentioned, there are other issues that will not be addressed. And it's very uncertain how they will be addressed in the future. However, I believe that more support from the Department of Interior needs to be provided so that they can assist the tribes and the individual Alati landowners. Without that support and qualified staff to be able to delve into the fractionalization issues and the boundary issues, it'll still be there.
So we're focusing on the money, but the corrective direction to the interior would be one very good part of the settlement, that going forward, theoretically, this would not continue to be an issue. So you would focus on that as a good that
yes,
would be a strong reason for supporting the settlement.
Yes, sir.
Independent of whether or not we can dispute about the money. Mr. Finley?
I agree. Now or near is the time to do it. But I think we need to be deliberate about it. The Indian beneficiaries need to be informed. They want transparency. The tribal leaders want transparency. So if this is to move forward, we need to keep that in mind, that that's what we want at the very least, because we're talking about 100 years of history here. Yet we're being asked, on the other hand, by some to say, well, don't ask questions right now. It could prevent things from moving forward. Your opportunity to ask questions will come later. That's a tough sell to people in any country who have experienced all the injustices over the years. It's not the same Indian country that once existed then. People are self-empowered, they're not afraid to ask questions, and they want their questions answered.
So, Mr. Finley, Mr. Nunez, what level of outreach have you seen or would you expect prior to the settlement? I mean, what do your members tell you that they're hearing about the benefits that will accrue to them from the settlement?
Well, in our case, the Santa Vera Lotus Association has supported the settlement. I'm not real sure about the allotment owners in Gila River, Salt River, in those areas. But I believe, as I mentioned earlier, that just getting out there and talking to them, making the presentations about the settlement will go a long ways to helping them understand. And through those presentations, then if there are questions, concerns, then we will hear about them. And then we, as the Indian Land Working Group, would also be willing to assist them with regard to their concerns.
Does Mr. Finley have time? Mr. Finley, you were going to answer.
I would have to agree with that comment. It's my understanding that there are outreach efforts currently in the works right now with an organization in the Northwest. Certainly, you know, ITMA would be more than happy to help assist in that process to get the information out to the people. And I think that if the parties involved were to participate in that, which it's my understanding that they do plan to, then I think that'll go a long ways in addressing some of the problems, concerns, and questions that I've heard within recent months.
Okay. Thank you.
From Arizona, Mr. Grijalva.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kind of a wandering question, but for all three. And thank you very much for your testimony. Very edifying. The issue of class notification is I've heard it from all three of you that it's important that Indian country be involved in knowing and being notified of what the proposed settlement is. The issue of collusion, I don't know how you resolve that other than to halt any legislative initiative until that is judicially investigated, which I think is a suggestion. But at the same time, there's an urgency. I want to deal with that urgency question. Can we accomplish putting together the legislation to carry out the settlement with urgency? And I think the issue of historical the 100 years is appropriate and it has to be part of the context. The last 14 years have to be part of the context. So there is, for many people, an urgency to move this settlement forward and begin to close this chapter and move on to other chapters, which requires the Department of Interior to continue to be continue their responsibility in a very serious way. So is it doable to move forward with urgency and with deliberate speed, or hold the process in abeyance until issues of class notification and collusion are settled? And I pose the question, can you, I pose the question, and I don't mean to make it either or, but it is, because I think, well, never mind. Go ahead.
I would support it moving forward. I would just hope that our recommendations that are in the written testimony are given due consideration as we move through this process. I hope that as many questions that linger out there are answered. And I hope that opportunity be given to those who fall through the cracks, who really aren't included in the Class 2 portion, be given an opportunity instead of just, well, you can opt out. I think that the history shows that these people deserve an opportunity. They don't always have the means, the financial means, or even the physical means that it takes, the wherewithal, if you will,
describe
to see that
opportunity
through.
For me.
I'm sorry?
Describe opportunity for me, if you don't mind.
Well, in my written testimony, we had offered a third option.
Okay.
I would say that we could meet the outreach efforts within the time frame that we were allotted. And again, if we just explain all the aspects of it and or answer the concerns as best as possible, I believe that we will get to the Indian landowners and the tribal governments to be able to bring this to closure.
Professor.
You know, there are probably 5,000 studies out there that all conclude one sentence, pretty much. And that is that people are okay to lose, they're okay to be adversely affected, as long as they feel the process was fair. And so far, I don't think they feel that way. This is a start. I recognize that there's urgency, but deliberation and transparency will be important here for what Congress does. You know, I know Congress has plenary power. We say so Congress can do it at once. My old dad, who was successively elected to our tribal council more times than anybody ever had been, he always said to me, so Congress has plenty power. They do.
We don't use it well sometimes, but it's plenty. At the end of that deliberate outreach with some urgency attached to it, is the goal unanimity of opinion, or is the goal for people to be informed, the people affected?
I would say both.
Okay.
I would agree.
Okay, thank you. Yield back, sir.
The gentlelady from Wyoming, Ms. Loomis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate this hearing. I'm just trying to help the tribes that reside in Indian country within the state of Wyoming, the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone, understand what is being proposed here. Chairman Finley, I want to clarify a little bit about how somebody can opt out. For those within the trust administration or damage claims classification, you raised some concerns about what the process would be for an individual. Can you or either of our other two witnesses today share any additional insight with me as to what framework the settlement agreement establishes for an individual who pursues the opt-out provision?
My understanding is that if one wishes to opt out, then they can seek their own legal counsel to pursue their concerns. Granted, however, there are a majority of our Indian people that may not have the means to do so. Right. However, we are still giving them that that option is there.
And I also understand that individuals with damage claims, they'll be given approximately $500 plus a stipend based on a preset formula. Do you know how this payment compares to past successful damage claims of this nature, or is there a standard that we can look to see if this is reasonable?
I'm not aware.
I'm not either, but I can say that this is new to Indian Country.
Okay.
The class action lawsuit as it's being brought forward now.
Thanks, Mr. Finley. Another question for you. You mentioned in your testimony that you think the attorney's fees should come out of the Equal Access to Justice Act, the EJIA fund, instead of the judgment fund, which may be reasonable, except I would alert you that EJIA places no firm cap on the amount of attorney's fees that can be recovered. So how would Congress ensure the level of funding being directed towards attorneys in this case is appropriate?
I don't know. As you pointed out, the decision rests with you. But if you would like an answer from me, I will work on that and get it back to the committee.
Oh, thank you. I'll mention to you that I, along with two other members of this committee, including Representative Herseth Sandland, who is here today, have recently introduced legislation that would require the federal government to make transparent the attorney's fees that are paid out under EJIA. For the last 15 years, there are no records of how much the hourly rate was, to whom they were paid, whether it was a settlement or a judgment amount that was paid out under EJIA, to whom. And so we're trying to shine some light on attorney's fees paid out under EJIA. Given the amount of attorney's fees in this settlement, and they appear to be somewhat open-ended. It's a pretty broad range, 50 to 100 million. What assurance is there that Indian Country will ever know how much attorneys ultimately receive as a result of this settlement?
I don't know that we will know. I would like to think that we would, considering everything that's at stake, all the individual beneficiaries who will be compensated or choose to opt out or whatever happens as we go through this process. But as you heard today, people are interested in that topic. People are concerned about it. They want to know the answers to that. So I'd like to think at the end of the day, we would be able to see that number and know and look at it. And you mentioned earlier that that you were unaware what the attorney fees were, etc. I thought our tribe was the only one that had that problem, but evidently I was wrong.
That is true throughout EJIA, and that's true regardless of the federal agency that has been sued under EJIA, and we hope to rectify that. Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
From New Mexico, Mr. Heinrich.
I just have a comment for Chairman Finley. I appreciate you bringing up the issue of consultation with tribes on the implementation of the Tribal Land Consolidation Fund. I think if that is... if we are to approve this, that's a critical piece moving forward, and I would certainly welcome the opportunity to press for adequate consultation if this is the, as we move forward on this.
Appreciate that.
General Lady, South Dakota, Ms. Hersha Sandlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any questions for this panel, but I do want to thank you for having this hearing. I thank the witnesses for their perspectives and what they've offered to the committee. Mr. Chairman, as you know, I represent 9 sovereign tribes in South Dakota, and this agreement, if approved by Congress, would have a profound impact on the state. There are approximately 20,000 of the accounts that are held by individuals within the state's borders. And this is the largest number of any state. We do know that there are various either regional, the national associations, or individual tribes that are weighing how this should go forward, possibly looking at resolutions, desiring more hearings, more consultation, more information. In that regard, I do think it's important that as we assess the views of the various account holders, that they do feel, as the professor indicated, that there was a fair process, that they had a chance to fully understand the ramifications of this agreement. And in that respect, I do want to recognize Ms. Cobell. She has taken the time to visit Indian Country in South Dakota, most recently in the Pine Ridge and Rosebud reservations, to answer questions. And I think it's just important that we ensure a fair process. And part of that is having this hearing today to get a better, broader perspective of the ramifications of the agreement and the perspectives of the administration, different tribal leaders, as well as Ms. Cobell herself. So I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity.
Any other members of the committee wish to be recognized? If not, gentlemen, we thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The committee will now hear from the Honorable David Hayes, the Deputy Secretary, U.S. Department of Interior, accompanied by the Honorable Hillary Tompkins, Solicitor, U.S. Department of Interior, Washington, D.C., and our second panelist will be the Honorable Thomas J. Perrelli, the Associate Attorney General from the Department of Justice. We welcome each of you. We do have your prepared testimony. It will be made a part of the record as if actually read. David, we'll recognize you first. Welcome back to the committee.